Septimus Warren Smith, who found himself unable to move, heard the man speak. 30, pale-faced, wearing brown shoes and an old coat, Septimus Warren Smith had that worried look in his brown eyes that makes complete strangers feel worried too. Everything on Bond Street had come to a stop. No traffic could get past the grey car outside Mulberry's. Mrs. Dalloway, coming to the window with her arms full of flowers, looked out. Everyone looked at the car. Septimus looked. There it stood, the blinds pulled down, and on them a strange pattern like a tree, Septimus thought. Watching in terror, everything slowly came together into one centre before his eyes, as if some horror was just below the surface, about to break through. "It is I who am in the way," he thought. Wasn't he being looked at and pointed at? Wasn't he rooted to the pavement for a purpose? But for what purpose? "Let us go on, Septimus," said his wife, a little Italian woman with large eyes and a pointed face. But Rezia herself could not help looking at the car and its blinds pulled down. Was it the Queen in there, going shopping? "Come on," said Rezia. But her husband, for they had been married 5 years, jumped and said, "All right," angrily, as if she had interrupted him. People must notice, Rezia thought, looking at the crowd staring at the grey car. She admired English people, with their children and their horses and their clothes, but they were just people now, because Septimus had said, "I will kill myself." It was an awful thing to say. Suppose they had heard him. She looked at the crowd. "Help! Help!" She wanted to cry out to the butcher's boys and the women. "Help!" Only last autumn, she and Septimus had stood by the river, wrapped in the same cloak, laughing. But one must hide failure. She must take him away into some park. "Now we will cross," she said. She had a right to his arm, though he gave it to her without feeling. What he gave her, though she was so young and simple, only 24, without friends in England, and had left Italy for his sake, was only a piece of bone. The car, with its blinds down, hiding a person of the greatest importance, perhaps the Queen, Prince or Prime Minister, advanced towards Piccadilly, solemn, mysterious. "It is probably the Queen," thought Mrs. Dalloway, coming out of Mulberry's with her flowers. "The Queen is going to visit some hospital. The Queen is going to open some church fete," thought Clarissa. Slowly and silently, the car went on its way, carrying that very great person, whom history would remember, to light a spark among Hugh Whitbread and the gentlemen of England that night in Buckingham Palace. And Clarissa, too, was giving a party. She stood a little straighter, as if standing ready to greet her guests at the top of her stairs. The car had gone, but it had caused a tiny wave which rolled up Bond Street. For 30 seconds, all heads were turned the same way, and in all the hat shops and glove shops, strangers looked at each other and thought of their king, their country, the dead. A small crowd, meanwhile, had gathered at the gates of Buckingham Palace. Poor people, all of them, waiting to see the car. The Queen might pass by and look at them, or the Prince. "The Prince might be coming along in the morning to visit his mother," Sarah Bletchley said, with her baby in her arms. Suddenly, the sound of an aeroplane filled their ears. There it was, coming over the trees, letting out white smoke behind it, writing something, making letters in the sky. Everyone looked up. But what letters? Was it a C, an E, then an L? The letters moved and melted up in the sky. Then the aeroplane flew further away and, in a fresh space of sky, began writing a K, an E, a Y perhaps. "Glaxo," someone said. "Cremo," said Sarah Bletchley. At the gates of Buckingham Palace, people looked up into the sky, and in this extraordinary silence and peace, bells struck 11 times, the sound fading up there among the birds. The aeroplane turned and raced exactly where it liked.
"It says toffee,"
said a man, as the grey car went through the palace gates and nobody saw it. Redseer Warren Smith, sitting by her husband's side on a seat in Regent's Park, looked up.
"Look, look, Septimus," she cried.
For Dr. Holmes had told her to make her husband, who had nothing at all serious the matter with him, but was not quite his usual self, take an interest in things outside himself. So, thought Septimus, looking up, they are making signs to me. Not in actual words, that is, he could not read their language yet, but this beauty was clear enough. Tears filled his eyes as he looked at the words melting in the sky and presenting him, in their extraordinary goodness, one shape after another of incredible beauty. Tears ran down his cheeks. They were advertising toffee, a woman told Retzia. Together, they began to spell T-O-F. F-E-E, said the woman, and Septimus heard her rough voice close to his ear, which sent waves of sound running up to his brain. What a wonderful discovery that the human voice could bring trees to life. Thankfully, Redseer put her hand down heavily on his knee so that he was weighed down, or the sight of the trees rising and falling, would have sent him mad. But he would not go mad. He would shut his eyes. He would see no more. But the trees called to him. The leaves were alive. The trees were alive. And because they were connected with his body, when the branches stretched, he stretched too. A child cried. Far away, a dog barked.
"Septimus,"
said Retzia, and he jumped violently. People would notice.
"I am going to walk to the fountain and back," she said.
For she could bear it no longer. Dr. Holmes might say there was nothing at all serious the matter. She would rather he was dead. She could not sit beside him when he stared so hard and did not see her and made everything terrible. The sky and trees, children playing, dogs barking, all were terrible. And she could tell no one.
"Septimus has been working too hard," was all she could say to her own mother.
To love makes one alone, she thought. She could tell nobody, not even Septimus now. Looking back, she saw him sitting in his old coat, alone on the seat, bent forward, staring. And it was cowardly for a man to say he would kill himself. But Septimus had fought in the war. He was brave. He was not Septimus now. He never noticed her. He was happy without her. Nothing could make her happy without him. She looked down at her hand, spreading her fingers. Her wedding ring was loose because she had grown so thin. It was she who suffered, but she had nobody to tell. Italy was far away, and the white houses, and the room where her sisters sat making hats, and the busy streets. In Milan, the streets were crowded every evening with people walking, laughing, not half alive like people here, looking at a few ugly flowers.
"For you should see the gardens in Milan," she said aloud. But to whom? There was nobody. Her words faded.
I am alone, she cried, by the fountain in Regent's Park. She was his wife, married years ago in Milan, and would never, never tell anyone that he was mad.
She turned, and there he was, still sitting alone in his old coat, staring, talking aloud. Septimus listened to the voice which spoke to him, telling him he had come to save society. Men must not cut down trees. Change the world. No one kills from hatred. He wrote such things down on the backs of envelopes. He waited. He listened. A bird on the fence opposite sang, Septimus! Septimus! 4 or 5 times. And then loud words in Greek about life beyond a river where the dead walk. White things were gathering behind the fence, but he could not bear to look. Evans was behind the fence.
What are you saying?
Said Retzia suddenly, sitting down by him. Interrupted again. She was always interrupting. They must get away from people, he told her, jumping up. Over there, in the chairs beneath a tree. There, they sat down under the tree.
Look,
she begged him, pointing at a group of little boys carrying cricket things. For Dr. Holmes had told her to make him notice real things. Go to the theatre or play cricket. That was a nice game, just right for her husband.
Look, she repeated.
Look, commanded the voice that told him he was the greatest of all men, taken from life to death to suffer forever. But he did not want it, he cried, with a wave of his hand.
Oh, look,
Retzia begged him, for he should not talk aloud to himself outdoors. But what was there to look at? A few sheep. That was all.
Could they tell her the way to Regent's Park tube station?
Maisie Johnson wanted to know. She had only arrived from Edinburgh 2 days ago.
Not this way, over there,
Retzia cried, waving her away in case she saw Septimus. Both of them seemed strange, Maisie Johnson thought. Everything seemed very strange. She was only 19 and in London for the first time to start a job at her uncle's business. And now, walking through Regent's Park, this couple on the chairs gave her quite a shock. She thought she would never forget it, even in 50 years' time. The young woman, jumping and waving her hands, seemed foreign. The man looked so awfully odd. Perhaps they were quarrelling. Perhaps they were parting forever. Something was wrong, Maisie knew, and it had quite upset her. Above her, the aeroplane raced, away and away, until it was nothing but a bright spark. Then it rushed over St. Paul's Cathedral, strange and silent. Not a sound could be heard up there over the noise of the traffic. And now, from behind the aeroplane, going up and up, straight up, in pure joy, poured white smoke, writing a T, an O, an F.